University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers and performers to the campus throughout the semester to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents Dale Van Atta, co-writer of the Washington Merry-Go-Round for the Washington Post. His lecture is entitled Scandals, Scoundrels, and Saints. Van Atta is the youngest and most widely syndicated news columnist in the world, with more than 50 million daily readers. News-grabbing stories are his specialty, as evidenced by his coverage of the Iran-Contra affair, the Pentagon procurement scandal, Iran's worldwide terrorist network, Panamanian leader General Manuel Noriega's drug running, and the Reagan administration. His work as a reporter has been rewarded with 7 Pulitzer Prize nominations for investigative journalism. His persistence in tracking the truth has won him the scrutiny and fury of presidents, CIA directors, and world leaders from Leonid Brezhnev to Yasser Arafat. He has reported from all 7 continents and was once the target of an assassination plot orchestrated by renegade CIA agents.
Large gathering for the morning. I do so much reporting on the CIA that it is always a delight to wear a microphone that I can see. I'd like to talk this morning a little about Washington. I hope some of you will stay for the talk back as the questions get quite interesting sometimes. I'd like to talk about making right choices and effectively talking about making right choices in your life by the attempt that is made in Washington to make right choices. Last spring, I was scheduled to come here. Some of you may have been attending Wesleyan at the time. And I was in an unusual circumstance. I was an arrest warrant had been put out for me in Syria, where I left the hotel in about 10 minutes when I heard about it and hid in a home for a week. And it was during that week when I was supposed to be arrested either at the airport or at the border when I was leaving that I was unable to get to you to speak to you here. I eventually ended up in Beirut, and this was last May, and was stood in the place where Terry Anderson and 2 of the other hostages were held as recently as last December. It is the kind of thing that I needed more time to do, so I apologize for not being here last May. In talking about making right choices, I suppose I should tell you about at least one of the wrong choices that I make so I don't set myself up as some kind of a self-righteous pariah. Probably the worst decision I ever made, and I didn't even think about it, was in 1982. And it was the time, aside from driving in Washington and elsewhere at sometimes speeds that are not legal, that I was at some danger to myself instead of outside danger. I went to Beirut. It was August 1982. The Israelis had invaded and surrounded Yasser Arafat and the Palestine Liberation Organization inside West Beirut. There was a green line, they called it. And if any of you have ever seen the movie Mad Max, have some of you seen that, or those the series Mad Max, the whole premise of Mad Max is that it's a future society in Australia where gas is gold and everyone is killing each other to get some gas for their hopped-up vehicles. It was something like that in Beirut. In those days, the only way to get into that part of the city, the western part, was through a series of bunkers that were very high. They were higher than probably the top of that door in the stage. And they were staggered like this, one after the other, so that you couldn't drive straight through. You had to wind around. I hired a taxi driver for a great price, probably an annual salary that he normally would have made, to go in there, because at that time there were so many guerrilla groups inside Beirut and it had been shut off in terms of gas, water, electricity, etc. There were so many different guerrilla groups vying for power. They'd get up in the morning, if they got up on the wrong side of the bed and anything was moving in the streets, they would start shooting at it. In fact, that whole day in this whole West Beirut, which used to be the Paris of the Middle East, there was only one other car that I saw moving that day besides our taxi, and it had about 15 Uzi-toting guerrillas shooting off as they went by through the canyons of the city. In this case, we went about 95 miles an hour through those bunkers, and a couple times it was on two wheels, and we did get shot at, but luckily whoever it was missed if it was just one person. Finally got inside, and I made a call in advance. Even though electricity was shut off and telephone contact, I found out the Israeli army actually had a line in there, and they knew what Yasser Arafat's number was. So I asked them if I could use their army field headquarters telephone and call them, and they said, yes, as long as you promise that you don't say where you're calling from. I said, fine. And talked to one of Arafat's aides, and he had not been seen for 2 weeks. The Israelis were trying to kill him at the time every day, so he never slept the same place twice every night and moved around a lot. But he hadn't given a press interview for quite some time, and he agreed to see me. As we got near the place where we were supposed to go, several aides came out, and we eventually had a meeting with Arafat in a bottom bunker. He had his own generator. He had a video recorder. He showed me some movies. And we talked about the situation in West Beirut. Toward the end of the conversation, I asked him about cluster bombs. Some of you may have heard of cluster bombs. The reason I had asked him is because the Israelis had bought these bombs from America years ago in the 1950s under an agreement which they had signed which said they could only use it for defensive purposes. And this meant defending your territory near your territory. Well, I heard they had been using them up near Beirut on some of the people there. So I'd ask him about it. Now, these cluster bombs, they come in about, they're little bomblets, actually, like grenades. There are about 400 or 500 in huge canisters that drop out of planes. And as all these drop out, they set themselves and charge themselves. And when they land, they explode. Most of them, except some duds, obviously. They're supposed to be anti-tank. The Israelis kept telling me, even if we are using them, they're anti-tank. They're not anti-personnel. They hit the soft part of a tank, like Syrian tanks, and explode it, and we stop the tank advance. Well, I argued, as I usually do with military people, that anything that explodes is anti-personnel. And in fact, that week, even as they were denying to me that they were using the cluster bombs, even as they were denying it, I heard over Israeli radio a warning to Israeli soldiers near Beirut not to pick up cluster bombs, that some people were thinking that they were like souvenirs, looking like little pine cones, and they'd pick them up and they'd explode. And three Israeli soldiers had been killed doing that, trying to pick these up as souvenirs. So I asked him about it, and he said that they were being used, and of course, you have to ask for establish your credibility. And he said he had some that were duds or that were not live. That was the implication, was that they were not live. And perhaps I'd like to see them. I said, fine. I looked at this table. There were a number of them there. I said, what would you suggest? He said, well, take one of these ones, one of these harmless ones, was the implication. Take one of these and take it back to the Pentagon and check the serial number and see if it is an American-bought cluster bomb. And then you can say you found it in Beirut. I said, well, that sounds sensible. So I threw it into my suitcase. Now, the Israelis went through my suitcase. They have tremendous security. They saw this and other, I had artillery shells in there, some other things, because I was not a military expert and couldn't identify these things and wanted to get some of my friends in Washington to identify them. They were obviously, they were empty artillery shells that had been used. I wanted to see where the PLO was buying from. I got back to Washington, had it checked out, had the serial number. I went through New York in such a hurry. Some of you may have done this, changing planes, that you have to carry your own suitcase on board. Well, I did that. I was in such a hurry. I put the suitcase on the X-ray machine. I forgot what was in there, what it looked like an arsenal inside there. I mean, it was just sheer dumb luck. And then the stewardess very kindly put it next to the pilot at the front of the plane. Well, I got back to Washington and put it in my home, put it up in my garage. After I'd done I did one story, no big deal, and had it up in the home for about a year. It fell a couple times. It went through all the seasons in Washington, summer, winter, fall. And then my wife got a little concerned because she had never really seen it. And she picked it up once, and it was heavier than all the other things, and she is a lot brighter than I am, and said, you know, this may still be filled. And that, in which case, it'll blow up this house. Can you please get it checked out? And she, some of you are married, know how wives can be, and husbands. She nagged me for a couple months, and I finally called a friend at the Pentagon and said, I got this thing and talked the same day to a friend at the FBI, so they got together. And the next day at my home, I was sitting there trying to write a story, and I got a knock at the door, and along comes this FBI agent and an Army explosives ordnance man. And the Army guy says to me, "I understand you have a cluster bomb." He's got this very quizzical look on his face. "You have a cluster bomb?" I said, "Yes, but it's not live." He said, "Well, we're here to check it out, you know, just to determine whether it's dangerous or not. Would you please get it?" So I rushed in the garage, grabbed it off the shelf, came out, and his face turned white when I came through the garage door. He said, "Don't make another move." So I paused, and he said, "You see that yellow band around there? That's high explosive. Can't you tell the pin is pushed in and it hasn't gone off and it's still alive?" I said, "Well, I was a little curious about that." But I assumed Arafat knew what he was talking about, and the Israelis had looked at it. Maybe they didn't want me around either. Well, he took it back. He rushed back to his truck while I stood there frozen. He came back with a pair of tongs, very carefully took it from me, walked slowly to the truck, and they exploded it on some Army range somewhere in a garbage can, probably. And when he got back, here the FBI agent was taking notes. One of these days I want to see my file. And he said, "We have been to a lot of American homes picking up ordnance, picking up old World War II souvenirs and other things and that are still alive. But we have never been to a home in Sterling, rural Virginia, and picked up a cluster bomb. Where did you get it?" I said, "Well, Yasser Arafat gave it to me." "And he told me to take it to the Pentagon." Okay, that's the dumbest thing I ever did. And it was, for some reason, I somehow come through these things. In this case, it ended up being one of the finest columns that I ever wrote. I decided that it was time to admit such stupidity, given the fact we were pointing it out in others all the time. The one thing that I didn't say was getting it on the plane. I talked to the head of the FAA at the time and said, "I got this through and I wasn't trying. I didn't want to test your system. It was just stupid." And I said, "What was the problem?" And so he very sheepishly said to me, "Well, at any given time, about 20% of our X-ray machines are out all across the country." I said, "What do you tell the guards?" "Well, we tell them to look as if they're seeing something on the machine and to look at you suspiciously." I said, "You know, I don't think that'd be a good idea to report that. It would encourage terrorism if I suggest it was easy to get a bomb aboard a plane." And he said, "I agree with you." So I didn't write that. But I did find that there were a number of people across the country who had picked up old things, including in some of the museums. There are still Civil War balls, and the museum directors don't know it, that they're still live. They have an explosive charge in them that has not gone off, and they have them in these piles that may someday go off. So I asked him if there was some way I could help this Army ordnance man. He said, "Yes, we had a lot of kids lose fingers, eyes, and get killed in the last 6 months." So I wrote a story for Christmas Day and explained that I had gone through this experience and had foolishly risked the lives of my family. And perhaps some of you out there on Christmas Day should do yourself a favor and get that stuff checked that's in your home. The Army later sent me a very nice letter a couple months later. They had tens of thousands of calls at Army bases across the country. The column that Jack Anderson and I write appears in more than 800 newspapers, so it had a tremendous response. And what they told me was that 95% of what they checked out was live. This was grandparents who had things in boxes in the basement. So it's a case of turning lemon into lemonade, and I did a couple more columns after that. Well, let me talk briefly about the Middle East. And here is a question about making a right choice. I'd like you to recall for a moment how you felt when you saw that videotape of Colonel Higgins hanging. Did most of you see that on the news? How did you feel about the Arabs then? How did you feel about America and what we should do? I believe if a poll were taken on that day or over the next week, 90% of the country would have said, "Lynch them, go in, we don't care who you kill." That was the attitude that I was hearing in Washington. And it gave me some pause. I had been in the Middle East several times. I had learned that peoples are the same everywhere, but that leaders are also can be corrupt and then the people follow them. So there are many good Arabs, just as there are mostly good leaders in Israel. And I began to think about it a little more and started to think, what is it that we should do about terrorism? I had spent a lot of time on it over the last several years. I'd seen what the government had done. Very hard to make a decision about that. What I did learn when I was in Beirut is there is no way to know where any of our hostages are at a given moment. We can get intelligence within about a week of the time the hostages are there, but never on one specific day. There was one time when this may have occurred, and you probably have never heard this. Terry Waite, the Anglican Church envoy who has been a hostage for a long time, shook his guards in December 1987, as I remember, and was taken hostage that night. The sources that I had in Beirut told me that they believed he was a CIA plant, that he had been a willing front the entire time for the CIA for the arms for hostage deal. If you remember, during that whole arms for hostage trading, the man who got credit for getting those three hostages out that were eventually gotten out was Terry Waite. Tremendous publicity and attention, and yet they were paid for. So did Waite know? The terrorists believed that he did. And according to these sources, including sources I gained in Hezbollah, the main terrorist group, he had a wire on him. There's only disagreement about where it was. There are some CIA people who are very cautious about talking to me about it. The Hezbollah officials claim there was a bug in his hair. That night shaking his guards was a last attempt, knowing he might meet with the hostages, to inform the CIA of a specific time and place where the hostages were and have them come in with the military forces. Unless you have that kind of intelligence, it will be a conflagration if we go in there. And it's the kind of decision you have to make on that kind of a basis. These hostages are kept by families. It's groups within groups that fight against each other. And they're kept by families and nephews and nieces and cousins who trust each other. And if any of us, if any American military force came near those hostages, we believe, myself and the people that deal with the Middle East, they would be killed. If you cannot make a surgical strike, an attempt to find out where they are and get them out, your next option is then to seek revenge or retribution. And that's what many people felt. The same day that occurred, I was speaking at an international platform association. It was an unusual gathering because they have about 150 speakers or more from around the country, some of the world's best, speaking every half hour. A half hour before me was Tom Clancy, the famous author of the four bestsellers. And he was so angry, most of the last of his speech, the last half hour, was about how we should do something to those towel heads in the Middle East. And the man who was to speak after me was Gordon Liddy. So the fact that I was sandwiched in between those two men gave me a little pause when I was thinking about what I should say and came to something that really rang true for me. And that is that American strength is not based, to me, on military strength. It is based on moral strength. And at any time that we turn aside the moral strength of this country, the kind of credo that the country was based on, we are at a great loss and need to think twice. As I began thinking about that, I realized no matter what we did, if we went in there with any kind of a force, innocents would be killed. And the cycle of violence would continue. There are only two groups I realized as I was going through my mind on the ones who had been successful against terrorism. Have the Israelis been successful against terrorism? You know that if something happens to them, if three Israelis are killed in a bus, they will bomb southern Lebanon the next day and kill 100. You get an idea of how they value the lives of fellow Israeli citizens when you see the numbers of who they kill. After some of their people are killed, they're willing to trade two Israeli prisoners for 1,300 Arab prisoners they're holding. They bomb immediately. Has the cycle of violence stopped for Israel? Is their retribution policy effective? No. There are two groups for whom it has been effective. And let's examine them just a moment. The first group is a country, Russia. Do you think there is anyone in the Middle East who would take a Russian hostage today? No. And the reason is because several years ago, four Russian diplomats were taken hostage. One of them was killed in short order by the terrorists because the Russians refused to meet with their demands. And the Russians got angry. They took a Hezbollah leader and started sending him over the period of the week in pieces in the mail to Hezbollah leaders, fingers, etc. And their three diplomats were released unharmed within a week. No one would take a Russian hostage in the Middle East today because of that. There are some in the American government who suggest that is what we do, and that is what we should do. The only way to meet violence is with violence that is greater. And there are real factions within the government who fight for this, who will cite polls about military strength. One of the things you may never have heard, and it may make you a little more cynical about the government. I don't want to make you too cynical. In 1986, before we bombed Libya, secret polls were taken to see whether you would support it. And it was even more insidious than that. They were taken by the National Security Council. Unprecedented. The president usually has his own polls. It's paid for by the Republican National Committee, or if the president is Carter, the Democratic National Committee, to see what the nation is thinking. But in this case, the National Security Council secretly spent $1 million with a private think tank, calling 1,760 people four times during 1986. And the first question on the first poll in January 86 and the same question in March was, would you support military action against the following terrorist sponsoring countries? In January of that year, that poll said that 65% or so would support military action against Iran, and it was under 50% against Libya. By March, after all the publicity had spewed forth about how terrible Gaddafi was, in March, that had changed. It was over 70% for Libya and less than 60% for Iran. By the time they bombed Libya, they knew they had your support. Has it stopped terrorism? No. The fact is, Gaddafi has become far more clever. Instead of becoming directly involved with some of the terrorists, he uses intermediaries now. He doesn't talk so much as he used to over the telephone system. We were intercepting his actual conversations with his operatives in Europe. He has decoded to a greater degree some of his cables that go from embassy to embassy, so it is getting more difficult for us to read them. And he has been secretly sponsored. If you think terrorism has stopped from him, a year ago, a Japanese Red Army terrorist, Yoki Kimura, was arrested as he was about to bomb three different locations, including the UN in New York City, and it was for Gaddafi. He's never admitted that, but we had the clear evidence of it. So military support, military antagonism, military response is not always the answer. How could Russia do that? Because Russia is a country, I spent 3 weeks there in July, about a month and a half ago. Russia is a country that over the last 70 years systematically dehumanized its citizens. The value of human life in Russia is minimal. The Soviet Union cared not a whit for those three diplomats. I firmly believe that. They cared about national pride. It didn't matter to them if chopping up one of the Hezbollah leaders piecemeal meant that the terrorists would do the same thing to their three diplomats. They simply did not care. If I were to ask you what is the greatest pogrom, I mean wipeout of a race, in the last century, would you likely name the Jews in World War II 6 million? That's not the case. Joseph Stalin in the 1930s wiped out upwards of 20 million Russians. at least 5 million Ukrainians were deliberately starved to death. There were many different reasons for this, many political purges, many religious purges at the time, and he was attempting to change the farming system of the entire country, moving peasants from one place to another, putting on them unnecessary quotas, going to their houses and farms with police, and if they found any grain left for the family, they would seize it and put the farmer in jail for holding out on the state. They cared not a whit about leaving anything for the farmers to continue producing. 20 million people. And they lost 20 million more in World War II. They have learned how to lose individuals and remain as a country. Sometimes I wonder, why is our reaction to terrorism so strong? How many people can you count that have been killed by terrorists? How many Americans? The number's probably a little over 400 now. How many Americans are killed on the nation's highways in the course of a month? How many are killed as a result of drug-related activities? Many more. And yet the government, because of public response, has spent billions of dollars, and it is that high, trying to train counter-terrorist forces. The face of Washington's changed in the last 10 years. If any of you had come 10 or 15 years ago, Washington would have seemed very open. Now, if you go to government buildings, besides all the X-ray detectors, you can't even get close with your car to any of the buildings. There are all kinds of bunkers and spikes and other things to prevent you from getting there. Washington became more of Fortress America, starting in 1981 with the alleged Libyan hit squad. So our response to it has been enormous. If it really came to America, and there is some terrorism in America, some domestic terrorism, the thing that I have always feared, if Middle East-sponsored terrorism came to America, a couple airplanes were blown up with people inside it, that our fear would be so great that we would support the suspension for a brief time of some of our civil liberties, including for those who are arrested. An unjustifiable response for something that would be, in effect, a minimal threat. We would have to become more like Russia. It was interesting when I was there, I traveled at one point with a very conservative group, very conservative Republicans. Didn't think George Bush was conservative enough. And when we were in Leningrad, over the space of 2 hours, three of them were mugged. And these good conservative Republicans came back to the hotel, and the conversation at dinner last night, very sincere conversation, was, "What's happened to the good old KGB? I thought Leningrad would be safe, state security. I thought they had cleaned up crime. They should get back out on the street and start cracking heads." Conservative Republicans who a week before would have lambasted the KGB and what they had done over the years in Russia. When it happens to you, it gets a lot more personal. And sometimes we react very strongly. We think the Russians are paranoid. Believe me, you and I are paranoid. The Russians have missiles on every one of their borders, and they face what they believe is an enemy, the America, which is the only country that has actually used nuclear weapons. If you look at it from their perspective, it begins to look a little hostile. We are so used to having oceans on both sides and a friendly country that a north and at least a non-invasive country militarily to the south, sometimes friendly, Mexico. And when they dared attempt to put missiles within 90 miles of our border, and mind you, we have some closer than 90 miles to their border, in Cuba, the world was at a nuclear crisis. We would not allow it. We respond in that way, whether you realize it or not. We do not want to become like Russia in responding to terrorism. Now I'll tell you about the second group and get into the subject of the week, drugs. The only other group that has succeeded in stopping terrorism against itself is a group that started with a man named Fabio Ochoa in November 1981. And if you think that terrorism and drugs and all these things, these are not shadowy people who are running these operations. They are human beings with the same motivations as criminals in the United States. And in this case, it was classic Godfather It was a classic read of the Godfather book by Mario Puzo, or a classic seeing of the movie. A leftist guerrilla group, M19, the April 19th movement, kidnapped young Marta Ochoa, 26 years old, who was attending a university in Medellin. They had kidnapped hundreds of wealthy daughters and sons over the previous 2 or 3 years and had raised money for their arms by selling these kids back to their wealthy parents. Ransoms were the way that they were funding their revolution against the government. And they demanded several million dollars from her father, Fabio Ochoa. He was furious, but even more furious was his young son, Jorge Luis Ochoa. And he said, "We cannot give in to these terrorists." And he reckoned quite rightly that it was a threat that might face all the drug dealers in Medellin, because that's what the Ochoa family was, the first family of marijuana at the time. Cocaine was just beginning to be a big Colombian product, and they were beginning to get into it. The M19 group knew that, and it was a way for them. They realized all these people would be wealthy soon from the drug profits, and they would just kidnap their kids for ransom, give the kids back, buy arms, and fight the government. This leftist guerrilla group. They met November 19th, 1981, in a restaurant outside Medellin called Las Margaritas that was owned by the Ochoa family. More than 200 drug dealers from Medellin. And Jorge Luis Ochoa made a brilliant speech, which made them all feel that they were threatened. He said, "It is my sister first. It will be your sister, your children next, unless we do something now." There was a lot of muttering. They all agreed. Then there was discussion of what to do. Within 10 minutes, they realized the one way to stop terrorism was to fight terrorism with terrorism. Over the course of the next week, they hired and trained more than 200 assassins, mostly 14 to 17-year-old boys who were trained to shoot machine guns from motorcycles as they were riding. That's the way most of the assassinations in Colombia have been carried out. Spraying of cars with machine guns and people walking along the street as they go by on a motorcycle. They called their group Muerte a los Secuestraderos, Dores. My Spanish isn't that great. What it meant was death to the kidnappers. And in December, they dumped thousands of leaflets over a soccer match in Cali saying that if anyone dared kidnap anyone else, that she should be released and anyone else, they would face death. Over the space of about 3 weeks, they killed probably 36 M19 revolutionaries. And M19 became the first terrorist group that capitulated. They returned Marta Ochoa unharmed, without ransom. And it has changed so much in Colombia. One of the things you may not know, this group has suborned terrorist groups. It has no ideology except to protect itself. Do you remember, I believe it was in 1986, when the Colombian Justice Building was burned to the ground? It was only a block from the presidential palace, a couple blocks from Congress. M19 guerrillas took the building over. There was a 27-hour siege. A conflagration occurred, and 12 of the 24 Supreme Court justices in Colombia died in that fire, and all of the terrorists. The reporting at the time and since has been that M19 did this for ideological reasons. In the last 6 months, we developed enough substantial intelligence, according to the top secret reports I occasionally read, to conclude that, in fact, M19 was paid $5 million to take over this building by the Medellin cartel. $5 million. What was the purpose of taking over the building? To kill the Supreme Court justices who were seeking extradition of cartel leaders to the United States and to destroy all of the files, the investigative files, on these drug leaders that was in the building. And they did just that. They destroyed them all and they killed all the Supreme Court justices. And over the last 3 or 4 years, it's turned into another Lebanon. There are many people in Colombia, the majority, the vast majority, who want to fight this drug peril. But they are often given the choice, those that become leaders, the choice of silver or lead. Either you take money from us, or we kill you or your family. Justice Minister was killed 2 years ago. And a few days after he was killed, the chief suspect was arrested on another charge, Jorge Luis Ochoa, the leader of the Medellin cartel. There are actually five main leaders, but he's the primary one. Pablo Escobar is another one. He was arrested for illegally importing cattle. And we demanded his extradition after because the justice minister had been killed. Before we could get down there to extradite him, he had been released. The judge either was paid or was bribed. You saw the justice minister, the current justice minister, come to the United States. She feared for her life. I have always considered in the last two or three years that if a terrorism threat faced the United States, it wasn't Middle Eastern terrorism, it's narco-terrorism. A number of Americans have been killed by the Medellin cartel. From that base in 1981, when they were virtually exporting no cocaine to the United States or a very small amount, they now control this one group by pooling their resources, their transportation network, their distribution. They now control 80% of the cocaine and crack that comes into the United States. And they were originally doing it to fight terrorism. They originally gathered together and realized they could make profits. They earn in excess of $7 billion a year. They seem to fear no one, not the Colombian Army, not the United States, unless they're extradited here. They fear being extradited to the United States, but they don't fear the United States in Colombia. They seem to fear no one. And all over Latin America, you talk about the way that this kind of evil spreads. They have suborned four or five governments. How did they get to Manuel Antonio Noriega in Panama? They got to him because it got so hot for them under this justice minister that was later killed, and this attorney general. It got so hot for them, they did have to leave Colombia for a short time. Where did they go? Panama. Noriega put them up at the top of the Marriott Hotel in Panama City for months. And they struck a deal with him. If he would launder their money into United States dollars, which is the currency used in Panama, they would provide him with millions of dollars over time. And they suborned his government, as well as others. Are you aware they nearly successfully assassinated George Shultz? August 8th, last year. They were furious because the United States pressure had forced the Bolivians to arrest their top contact, the man who was providing them all the cocaine paste in Bolivia. And Shultz came to give a speech about it. And it was sheer luck that as he was driving from the La Paz airport, which is very high and you drive down this mountain, he was very lucky that the explosives went poorly. They were launched too quickly. In fact, his car was damaged. One car was almost totaled. His wife was almost killed. As he was visiting La Paz, our Secretary of State, one of the pieces of news that I can give you today that you will never have heard, because it just happened this week, is about the contract that's been put out on President Bush. We have intelligence that has been conveyed to the Secret Service. There have been five death threats from the Medellin cartel. But we have an informer in Texas who has provided over the years substantial information about the cartel. And who has elaborated, he does know exactly where they are, about a group of 10 Medellin hitmen who are in Chihuahua on a ranch in Chihuahua, Mexico, preparing to come to the United States, gather arms they have already collected in Wheeling, West Virginia, and assassinate the President of the United States. As you may know, it's almost a relatively easy thing to do for a group of committed people who do not expect to return alive. If they're committed to do it, if they think there's a reasonable chance, the figures that have been tossed around range from a low of $100 million on President Bush's head to $3 billion. And we learned this intelligence the day before his drug speech on Tuesday, and it has intensified during this week. These Medellin leaders foolishly, and I say foolishly, feel that this would put a stop to the harassment that they're feeling down in Colombia. You and I know that such an attempt, if it's not even successful, if it's unsuccessful or successful, I hope will mobilize this country to do something down there. You and I also have a responsibility It is the drug user as much as the seller who is responsible, and maybe more so. And it happens everywhere, including in Nebraska. People are using drugs, and using these drugs, which some of them consider a casual recreation, using these drugs is killing innocent people and courageous people in Colombia today. People who are trying to put a stop to it. A few years ago, I was in Mexico speaking with the Attorney General, and I talked about drugs, how they had successfully stopped a great deal of marijuana coming to the country in the 70s. They had a successful campaign. I asked him what he thought, what more they could do. Not that they're that successful today. What more could you do? And he gave me this example. He said, what we see here in Latin America and Central America is that we are the diving board for your swimming pool. You have this huge, shimmering swimming pool of money and people who want drugs. And to poor people down here, especially farmers, it's the way to go. It's the only way to make a living. You eliminate the swimming pool, and we will find it very easy to eliminate the diving board. But no matter how many we arrest, more will pop up because the profits are so great. President Bush has outlined his program. I don't know how you felt about it. I was astonished. It was his first nationally televised address. As I watched President Bush from Washington, he has not changed in my mind from what I thought he would be like as president a year ago. When I think about it in my mind, I kind of compare him sometimes to Jell-O. Not that he doesn't have will. He is a strong man. He is not a wimp. But he's like Jell-O because it takes him a long time to set a policy. And then it's a little squishy after it's set. Reagan was totally different. Normally, Reagan would set a policy and not veer from it. And that's the way he led. Bush has taken 9 months to develop this drug program and effectively offered to pay $2.2 billion more than before for drug enforcement, prevention, education. Our annual budget is over $1 trillion. The President of the United States said the other day it was the greatest domestic threat facing this country, and he allotted $2 billion to it. If we have 100 million taxpayers, maybe we don't have that many. If we have 100 million taxpayers, how much does that come out to for each taxpayer? Is that $20 a piece? Is that my estimation? The number should have been much higher. Not that throwing money at something solves the problem. But if you're going to announce a major war on drugs, and what you really offer besides telling the nation that it's an immoral drug malaise and needs to do something about it itself, you have to show federal resolve with real money. Maybe even bite that word about taxes. Not that I want my taxes to be raised. What if he had said instead a $50 surcharge on every taxpaying citizen, or scaled based on those who are low income, those who are high income, so that you raise instead $5 billion or more overnight. And the programs he's cutting, he doesn't care about losing those programs. So what we see in Washington is not really a will to fight it. If he's identifying it as a war, he's not putting federal resources behind it. He essentially threw it back to the states and local citizens. And that's not an effective way to do it. But it doesn't surprise me because I know some of his performance during the Iran-Contra affair. And let me close with a few thoughts on that. Because government continues to make these kinds of mistakes because they're filled by human people. I was in an unusual situation in December 1985 because I knew we were trading arms for hostages with Iran. And it was appalling to me that the president who had come in on an anti-terrorism platform, he said he'd never deal with terrorists, was dealing with them and giving them arms to boot. At first, I didn't believe it. It was an anonymous phone call. That's the way we get our information sometimes. turned out to be from a disgruntled girlfriend of one of the married principals whose name you'd easily recognize. She knew who I was because I had written many stories about General Richard Secord in 1980, causing a grand jury investigation and his eventual shameful departure from the Pentagon and loss of security clearances for his involvement with ex-CIA agents in an Egyptian shipping scandal. So when this lady said, "Your old friend Dick Secord is trading arms with Iran, he's doing this," I didn't believe it. I see my time's almost run out. What I eventually did, I called one of his associates, and the next day I got a call from the Pentagon and was hauled into an office with Noel Cook, who was the chief counterterrorism man in the Pentagon at the time, a man I knew and somewhat trusted, very gregarious, cigar-smoking man. When I got into his office this time, he slammed the door, put all the combination locks on it. I thought he was going to start the windows to vibrating. Because in the Pentagon, the way that we negotiated this tremendous deal with the Soviets many years ago that allowed them the highest point in Washington from which they can intercept any conversation through whose window they can get with microwaves. And it's right in view of the Pentagon. So with these microwaves, they can listen in on the conversations. And in some of the more sensitive rooms in the Pentagon, they have windows that vibrate. It supposedly knocks the microwaves away. But he shut the curtains and he started speaking a whisper, said, "I understand you know about the Secord mission with Iran. I profess to know a great deal." And he asked me not to run the story. He said, "The president doesn't want you to run the story. He's asked that you not run the story. I'm conveying the message. If you do, hostages will be killed." Well, I can't go into length about it. Maybe we can do it during talkback. But the eventual result was that I wrote a series of columns, not about the arms for hostage deal, but about Iranian-sponsored terrorism at the same time as everyone else was writing about Libya in January 86. I was so angry about the way the White House was so effectively able to pin all the blame on Gaddafi. Now, I'm no supporter of Gaddafi, but Gaddafi's about the world's worst terrorist. He was then. He's gotten better as a result of the raid. He was incompetent. He couldn't even take an American hostage. He ended up having to buy an American hostage for $1 million, Peter Kilbourne, to assassinate him after the raid. As we were starting all this propaganda against Libya and against Gaddafi as the world's worst terrorist, we were dealing with Iran, who had killed by that time at least 264 Americans. At least, and we knew it. And we were dealing with them. And then in March, Gaddafi did something that was so unforgivable, we decided to bomb him. Actually, it was in early April. Partly as a result of this poll. The poll said, if one action can be pinned to Gaddafi, one terrorist action, support for military action against him will go off the boards. And he did the unforgivable. He didn't bomb our Marines. He didn't take our diplomats hostage. He didn't kill them. He didn't torture aid officials, as was done on a plane to Kuwait. Instead, he bombed a Berlin disco. Nobody bombs our discos and gets away with it. One American soldier was killed, and we decided to bomb his country and his home. We were attempting to assassinate him. That was the chief purpose. Can you imagine what he thought as he stood there in the ruins of his home, his adopted daughter killed? What a dummy I am. Why can't I be like my good friend, the Ayatollah Khomeini, who knows how to take them hostage? He's still got six of them. Who bombs them, who destroys their Marines, ends their lives. And instead of having bombs dropping on the Ayatollah's home, he's able to buy them from America and use them against whoever he chooses. That's how crazy that policy was. And then we wrote five columns on the arms for hostage deal. And no other journalist could confirm it at the time. Sometimes I have sources, they don't. Sometimes they have sources and can find things out that I can't. It just happened. In this case, I had a few good sources. And I had been personally asked February 1986 by the president not to run the story. A one-on-one session with President Reagan on the day that Marcos fell, the only meeting that he kept that day because I had sent a message I was about to run the story unless the president confirmed that he was behind it. He asked me not to run the story. I said I wouldn't for the moment. After he bombed Libya, we ran the story. Now, do you remember who he blamed in November for the failed policy? That he blamed the press. In the Time interview, he said, if it wasn't for the press, this policy would have worked. Ollie North, who may be a hero to some of you, lied during the Iran-Contra hearings. He had gotten so enmeshed as a small colonel in this affair that he actually thought he had a win. He did not, and he knew it. And he lied during the Iran-Contra hearings, and the senators didn't even know. Do you remember when he said it was a neat idea to switch the profits from the arms sales to the Iranians to the Contras? Right after that, he said no Americans were harmed during the entire period of this policy until the press started writing the stories in November. You look at the list the next time one of our hostages is threatened. Ask Joseph Sosipio if that's true. The man who was almost killed 3 weeks ago. Ask him if it's true. He was taken in September 1986. By November 1986, the same Hezbollah terrorists had taken three American hostages and sold three back to America. They were three for three and had 2008 TOW missiles to boot. It was already a failed policy. President Reagan had forgotten something that my favorite American president, Jefferson, never forgot. And that is that you serve all the people, not just a few of them. You are not a sovereign leader of the United States of America. You serve all the people. Jefferson's the man, you may remember him, Declaration of Independence. John F. Kennedy said at one point during a gathering of Nobel Prize winners, a dinner at his house, at the White House, the greatest gathering of minds ever to meet together, with the possible exception of when Thomas Jefferson dined alone. The same man who went to his inaugural address from a boarding house, not the White House, and got home so late because of all the well-wishers after the brilliant speech that because it was a Democratic boarding house, he arrived too late for dinner. It had all been eaten. It was first come, first serve. And the President of the United States went to bed that night without dinner and without complaint. The same man who was pilloried in a way President Reagan or Bush cannot imagine. If you think the press is hostile today, read the papers of that time. He was regularly called a liar, a traitor, and the thing that really galled him, a lecher. His wife had died since. His daughter was the first lady of the White House. There were rumors of liaisons. Some newspapers, respectable ones considered at the time, instead of calling him the president, would say the lecher just sent another bill up to the Congress. He got so mad at one editor, he went rushing down to the office, almost punched him in the nose, and said, I can't believe anything that I read in your newspaper except for the advertisements. Not so sure of those. This same man who was pilloried in a way that can't be imagined today wrote, after he was president, that were it up to him to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, he would not hesitate a moment to choose the latter. Newspapers without a government. Thank you very much.
Today's speaker on University Forum has been Dale Van Atta, co-writer of the Washington Merry-Go-Round. His lecture was entitled Scandals, Scoundrels, and Saints. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is a private undergraduate liberal arts college located in Lincoln, Nebraska. Approximately 1,300 full-time students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.